All right, everyone, welcome to the GGG podcast, a bonus interview episode. I am joined, as always, by Phil over here, but we are also joined by Austin, an employee of Obsidian Entertainment. Austin, how are you doing? And what have you been, have you had any time to play any video games for yourself this week?
I'm doing great. Happy to be here. I've been playing Helldivers, a bit of Helldivers. Just started Alan Wake 1 because my friend told me to play that before I play the second one.
Right.
So it's like an appetizer, I guess. I think the second one is much more of a solid thing. I'm excited for that. But the first one's pretty cool too. And then you heard of Slay the Princess? I've been playing that as well.
I am unfamiliar. What is that game?
It's like a time loop visual novel where you have to slay a princess, and how you go through that changes. Then you restart from the beginning and you have to slay her again, but how you reacted to her the first time changes how she like appears. And there's like hundreds of different routes through the game.
Okay. So very,
it's
like
a horror game too, so it's very creepy.
Wow. All right. Well, you definitely got like some genre favoritism in there with Alan Wake and this roguelike horror game.
I like creepy stuff.
All right.
Not exclusively,
I would argue to say that Helldivers is also kind of a horror.
I think the robots are pretty, they have a horror tinge to them. Less so the bugs, but yeah, those robots are freaking scary.
Yeah, terrifying.
Absolutely. All right, right on. Well, let's just get right to it, Austin. So, like, you are an employee of Obsidian Entertainment. I've been a fan of Obsidian for a very long time. What's your official title at Obsidian, and how did you get into that specific field in game development?
Yeah, I'm a officially here, it's area designer, but it's like a level designer position.
Okay.
I am working on the Outer Worlds 2 in that role. I had undergrad where I was in a multimedia program, and I found myself gravitating towards games. So then I went to grad school. Not the route for everyone, but for me, I was like, I'm good with school. Like, this will work for me if I can just put my head down for 2 years and go through like a boot camp.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked for me. So after I graduated there in 2020, I got my job at Obsidian.
Right on. And did you set out to be like a level designer or an area designer? Is that your specialty?
So I went into grad school having made my own games where I did the art, the programming, and the game design. It was like solo projects.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And there was four tracks in my program. It was art, which is like 3D modeling, programming, where you're like making an engine, producing, where they like manage teams, and then level design. And so I was like, I didn't really know what it really was. I was like, all right, I guess it's level design because I like art and programming, but I'm afraid of both of those on their own. so that's kind of like why I chose it.
Sure.
And then when I got there, I was like, oh, like I'm good at this. Like, this does align with the sort of things I like about games.
I really enjoyed the sort of polymath aspect of like, I made my own games and then I figured out what I did and didn't like because I had to do everything for it. I feel like for any sort of artistic or creative endeavor, that is a great way to get your feet wet. That's really cool.
Absolutely.
I think I really liked all of it. But like I know I'm not the best at any one of these things, so I want to be in the role where I can like combine all of these skills or interface with all these departments. And that's what level design is. So it's, you're working with writers and artists and programmers all together to like build out the actual experience of the game, which is like my bread and butter. So
that's really awesome.
Hell yeah.
When it comes to working like at Obsidian, was there anything that made you think, oh yeah, I want to go there? Were there any games that like spoke to you before you even knew about the job there?
Yeah, I mean, I really liked The Outer Worlds. I was I was itching for a new Fallout-esque sort of experience, you know, like a unique world with deep lore, but with a lot of player freedom. There's just not a lot of games that hit that itch. It's like Bethesda and Obsidian, I feel like.
Yeah.
And in grad school, we made Fallout mods. So that was very like, it was like, oh, I get to write. I get to build out levels. I get to do a lot of scripting. Like, I would like something like this. And then Obsidian like showed up and was like, oh, this is exactly what I was doing there. So it was pretty cool.
Yeah. When you say you made Fallout mods, for which Fallout was it for?
Fallout 4.
Oh, okay.
It was Fallout 4 in their creation kit engine, which is very, very involved. So I probably only scratched the surface, but I got like a taste for it. Because I really like that there's like the narrative stuff where you can write out. They have like branching narratives that you can write out in that. And that's the same thing we have in our tools. So I really like that.
Right on. And so like I've been a fan for Obsidian for a very long time. The first game that I remember being released by Obsidian was Knights of the Old Republic 2, which Knights 1, like, come on, one of the best games of all time, in my opinion. You know, old time gamer talking. But yeah, I really like Knights 2. I think like some people were disappointed because it wasn't as good as the first one, but it's like hard to live up to the first one of that game. I love that. Like, I also remember you guys releasing The Stick of Truth and just
I love that game.
Yeah, a lot of bangers.
So good.
Yeah.
I remember, I think, Obsidian 4, Knights of the Old Republic 2, which gave me my first, like, moment in a video game where I questioned my morality, because you were talking about, like, you know, being good or evil. You had a mentor character who was like, oh, you just gave that guy $5, but now he's got money that all the other people here don't have. And then you, like, see them kill that guy and take his money. And I was like, oh, man, sometimes being good can be bad. and that, like, I feel like that continued that level of writing and storytelling through every Obsidian game I've played, whether it was New Vegas or Stick of Truth or The Outer Worlds 1. So I think that's one of the things that always has drawn me and a lot of people back to it, is Obsidian storytelling is just next level. So,
yeah, I think there's a huge focus on reactivity. Letting players do what they want, and then the game doesn't ignore that. You know, instead we like kind of have a conversation with the player and play with them, like, oh, you did this thing. Well, did you expect that we would anticipate that and have an unexpected outcome? And I think those moments of surprise when you see those outcomes are so fun.
Right on.
It makes you feel like real in that world. It's mm-hmm. so good.
Yeah.
So good.
Actions have consequences? What? I don't understand. is there anything like working as an area designer, is there anything specific that you can talk about of like that's satisfying for you as an artist working on the specific aesthetic of the Outer Worlds 2? Because a lot of times, like when I look at the aesthetic, like you brought up already, it looks like Fallout. It kind of looks similar to like a Bethesda game, but I also get hints of like the aesthetic's almost a little Bioshocky, maybe like Bioshock Infinite a little bit, which I know that there's been a while since we've gotten a Bioshock game, but that's kind of where my brain has gone. Is that an aesthetic that speaks to you?
I definitely like it. That like retro future thing. I mean, that's Bioshock games, that's Outer Worlds, and that's a bit of Fallout. I'm into that. I actually have like this picture archive reference book, and it's all like totally Outer Worlds style imagery.
Oh, okay.
And to me, this stuff is so cool. I like combining the old timiness with like pulpy sci-fi stuff, so yeah, I think it does speak to me in a way. And I like humor too, so like there's not a lot of big games that have such constant humor as the Outer Worlds does, so I really like that I can pitch ideas that are humorous.
Yeah, I think so Phil and I were talking before we started the recording, and so we've both played the Outer Worlds 1, and something that is very unique is the humor, and I feel like there's a sense of like we're not taking ourselves too seriously, like we want to give you stories that matter and have consequences, but you know, I feel like with some other games, they pick a tone of everything is serious. The stakes are always high. Do you like that sense of narrative reprieve of being able to joke around, or not to the extent of like a Borderlands, which is just like one never ending joke, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's tough when really any piece of media or art sticks to one tone the whole way through.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes find that it can be a little tiring. So I do like that when your game's comedic, like The Outer Worlds is trying to be, the serious moments maybe hit harder because you have that change in tone.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that. And we can play with tone and we can surprise you with either like the surprise twist is a joke or the surprise twist is something very serious. And like both of those are satisfying because of like that playground. So I love that stuff.
As a area designer, level designer, is there anything like, is there ways that you find the humor is built into designing a space for a player to be in? Like, is there challenges regarding that, or is that something that, cause I feel like you're kind of tied into everything with area design. How is it doing that with humor in mind? That's a weird question. But...
No, I think it's a good question. And I know what you mean.
Yeah, thank you.
So I work with narrative designers. And so they're like the writers. And we will pitch ideas of what we're building. And part of those ideas is like humorous situations that we then try to manifest with like, well, what can the player do there? Like, yeah, we have a funny idea, but like, how do we make that interactive?
Mm-hmm.
Or how do we make the player the one who causes this funny, interesting thing to happen? So a lot of, like one of the most fun things for me is like, I built out a level and then I see an opportunity for something like that. Like oh, we could do this unexpected thing and have reactivity to that. And so maybe it's not entirely like the first pass of the level. We're not thinking through those minute things, but as we play through it repeatedly, we'll start to think, well, what if you also did this? What if this tied into this? And then we might adjust the level to support those like set pieces that we come up with.
Very cool.
Does that make sense?
It makes sense to me.
All right.
I feel like what you're describing is, this is just my combination of experience, like being on the back wall in an improv scene and like watching things happen and being like, okay, wait. There's a perfect moment for some, like seeing these patterns.
100%.
There's the game. Yeah.
And you have to do the, just like an improv, you have to kind of do the legwork at the beginning, you know,
mm-hmm.
You have to have a foundation so that you can then even see like, where can we polish this up? Like you can't start with all those specifics. You need to just gradually build it up.
Very cool.
Right on. Something I wanted to bring up is, and just to give Obsidian their flowers a little bit, is that I absolutely loved the Outer Worlds 2 reveal trailer that you guys had. I believe it came
Hell
out.
Hell yeah. It was pretty awesome, right?
It was amazing. It was, and I think like it's the humor in it was fantastic. While at the same time, like it looked like a cinematic masterpiece, and just calling out the gaming industry just for, you know, the reveal trailer tropes.
It's poking fun. I think it's fun.
And I really like, we brought it up earlier, but just like that level of like being able to not take yourself too seriously and to laugh at yourself is fantastic. So I wanted to remind, for anyone who hasn't watched the reveal trailer for The Outer Worlds 2, please go watch it. It's a lot of fun and it's not a long video. And I think that's the only media that's actually come out about the game. Am I correct in saying so?
I believe you are right. I believe so.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And so we've brought up a couple of other games, like, you know, a lot of reference to Bethesda, BioShock and whatnot. For you guys releasing a game in that genre How do you think, you know, and you don't have to get too into specifics, but how do you think that The Outer Worlds 2 stands out in that market? Like, we talked about the humor quite a bit, but what do you think sets it apart from, like, a Starfield or something like that?
I think just like the first game, our game is handcrafted, I would say. You know, okay. Like the experiences you're going through are all built by us.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of narrative and pacing control we can do, a lot of interesting dungeon designs because of that. I mean, Starfield does some cool giant freaking planet size procedural stuff.
Right.
So if you're wanting that scale, you know, that's what Starfield is there for.
Right. Well, that
I think if you want that more personalized or hand-built feel, that's kind of what our game offers. I mean,
sure. Yeah. No, that actually leads into,
at least that's what I like about it.
Yeah. Then that's something that I wanted to ask you about as well, where we see a lot of games that are coming out, and this isn't necessarily a brand new thing. It's been happening for many years now, but we have a lot of, generative design where it's like I played a lot of No Man's Sky. And so it's like, oh, there's all these planets, you know, you can go to, but of course they're, you know, they're not being handcrafted by a area designer. Yeah, exactly. And so, I guess, do you find yourself advocating in general for more specific design where you have level designers and area designers on, like, doing everything? Or I'm sure, like, some generative tools make things easier sometimes, but you lose that specificity.
I think there's some games that the scale is just not possible for a human to create.
Right.
So that design pattern literally baked into it is generative elements.
Right.
Procedural generation. Mm-hmm. So like the Starfield and No Man's Sky, like you can't build that feeling of a game without it.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe it certainly has its place. I think I'm interested in ways to take some of that, find ways to put that into more handcrafted stories, like, not speaking of like AI per se, but procedurally generated stories rather than procedurally generated like giant planes. Mm-hmm. And finding ways to make those meaningful, or like, yeah, maybe even taking an area and changing the context of what you're doing based on some sort of procedural elements, or taking into account of what you did previously, and it could change the context. But I'm just thinking it through.
I think we are seeing, like, as a lot of people talk about, like, AI development in the arts in general, like, a lot of game developers are like, no, we use AI for lots of things, like, not the AI that you're thinking of to, like, just make pictures or whatever. And I'm sure there's an element of that. But I feel like what you're talking about is maybe more, like, built into the game systems. For example, I'm playing Dragon's Dogma 2, and right now there's a lot of, like, I'm trying to make sure my pawn doesn't get sick with the sickness that could nuke my save file. So it's creating this game element where I just, like, keep looking at her side-eyed, like, what did you just say? Do I need to take care of, do I need to throw you in the river and kill you so that you come back without the virus? But that whole, like, sequences like that where it's built into the game designs.
It's systemic.
Yeah. I guess one other thing I wanted to ask about too is, when it comes to the, like, I feel like the sense of humor on your game is kind of like poking fun at much of the way that BioShock did about, like, Rand style economics. I feel like Outer Worlds 2 is kind of like this nice mocking of an extremely capitalist society.
That story was definitely built into the first game, so
yeah. I love that. And, like, this weird frontierism, like, it's sort of like the designs you were showing us and everything. I guess in terms of, like, building a game around that, does that come into the design as well? Like, that top-down narrative theming?
Yeah, I would say we're always looking at that when we're coming with like a pitch for an area, you know? Just like in the first game, it's like, how do we keep this in theme? How do we explore a new aspect? Like, what are the new elements of the world we're exploring with this? What are the elements of the theme we're exploring? Because we don't want to, we always want to explore something new, like a different corner of the universe, and that's what this area is for. That's what this area is for. And as you're playing it, you probably don't see it so mathematically. But through playing and charting your own path, you'll have your own view of like the world by the end.
Very cool.
Right on. Something I wanted to bring up was that in the first game, I know that you could end up like it's one of those games where like it'll let you kill any character in the game, which, you know, to me, like in my like writing experience, is like, oh my God, I have to account for the possibility that any of these characters could die. So, yeah, I don't know if you can say, but is that something that is being carried over into this game? And I don't know if that necessarily applies to level design, but is that something you have to factor in of like, oh, if this character dies, then that's the character that brings the player to this area, and now I have to figure out a different way to get the player to this area or something like that.
So I don't know how much I can speak on about our game, but I can
Sure,
speak
sure.
of the philosophy about it.
Perfect.
So if you notice that in the first game, there's some NPCs that are locked in a room you can't get to.
Yeah.
Those are
Okay.
those characters that without them, the game narrative will probably be too hard to put back together.
The
So they're
Untouchables.
the untouchables. There's very few, which is very impressive, but there are a few. But generally, yeah, there is discussions to be had about all the contingencies, right? Killing characters is contingencies, but so is what if you're not with a certain character when you go there? What if you killed one of your own allies before you go there and they had a big part to play in this thing? Or what if you were this was supposed to be a big quest with this group, but they hate you. So we do have to take into account all of that, and it a lot of our iteration time is catching those things. Like, well, if you do this certain combination or these group, this doesn't react, and our games are all about it reacting. So we have to put that in.
Pretty cool.
Right on.
Similarly, Paul wrote this question, but I wanted to ask about. Okay, there's an infamous 12-minute speed run in the Outer Worlds 1, with Tim Kaine and Leonard Boyarsky watching it. Are they taking steps to remove that possibility of a 12-minute speed run in the next game?
That's a great question, but I have no answer for it at this point.
Do I just go get him real quick and just
Yeah, I'll go get Leonard.
Yeah, easy, easy.
Yeah, I had to
I'm
ask
sure
about.
there is. What'd you say?
Well, I had to put that question in
No,
because
that's a great
I
question.
remember I remember when the 12-minute speed run came out and like just the energy was like, really? You figured out how to do this in 12 minutes.
So do they? I haven't seen that. Do they go through the whole game, or is there some crazy skip that they're doing? Do you
It's a
remember?
bunch of crazy skips. And I think that's what was so baffling about it. And which like speaks to the audience of the game that they care so much about the game
Oh yeah, they'll find it.
to figure it out. But it was crazy 'cause I don't remember exactly how like what the estimated time to complete the first game was. I know for just the main story, I think it's like around 30 hours or something like that. But yeah, it was pretty funny, so I
That's
wanted to put
great. All right,
it
maybe yeah. Can't say anything about it if we're doing that. If we're gonna block those unintended skips.
I feel like
Austin's over there taking notes like no more 12-minute
No
speed
more
runs in
12
the
minutes.
underline.
Fix.
Yeah, I don't
Underline.
got to bring some testers in to do some audits or something like
Oh, we
that.
have some great QA people, and maybe they can go see if they can pull off the speed run. We can have a competition.
Okay. All right. Right on. Well, yeah. I mean, That's it for our questions. But if there's anything specific that you can or want to talk about, Austin, about your process or about what you're working on, again, I don't know how much you can talk about because of the limited information Obsidian's released on the game so far. I'm excited for it. I'm always looking for a narrative-driven game. There's been so many multiplayer games that have come out, or generative games that are kind of unspecific, and I find myself as a gamer craving those more specific experiences.
Do you have a favorite?
A favorite,
like more handcrafted or linear or single player experience?
I actually think I mentioned this on this week's episode of our podcast, co-op competition that we put out, where I think for me, it kind of started, I don't know if this is my favorite, but it started with Uncharted.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Where for me, and as a performer, seeing oh, a video game can really be like a movie. And when you actually get specific in the writing and in the characters, it increases the quality so much. It's like one of the things that deters me from very hardcore RPGs. I shouldn't say deters, that's a little bit of a strong word, but it's like when you can create your own character, I think that's awesome when you can create your own character. But at the same time, sometimes I don't want to create my own character because I want my character to have a personality. I really like The Witcher for that reason. It's I can make decisions as Geralt, and this can be my version of Geralt, but there was intention behind who his character is. I don't know. maybe Uncharted. Recently, the newest God of War, I was absolutely in love with. So I know Phil's a big Spider-Man fan.
Oh, yeah. those games craft such a great story. It's interesting because this last year, we all kind of went collectively pretty wild about Baldur's Gate 3 because that did a lot of your decisions matter, that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that game is, I think, it feels like a boutique. It feels like a huge game, but it is also a boutique, very specifically story designed game.
Yeah.
But sometimes I don't want to think about my choices a lot. I just want to sit down and have a good story told to me.
Yeah. Yeah. You just want to be taken on a ride.
Yeah. And there's a lot of great little indies that do that. Specifically recently, it's an action combat game, All About the Beat. What is it?
All About the Beat. That's All Dance About Dance the Revolution.
No,
I don't know that one.
Saxophone Star.
Saxophone Star 2. You know what? I'm gonna look for it, and I will tell you guys in a second because I completely forgot it because I liked it so much.
Yeah,
can't wait.
Clearly. What about you, Austin? Are there any games that you specifically resonate with? Obviously the stuff you haven't worked on.
I really loved just the theme of BioShock Infinite.
Mm.
Something about that, there is some overlap with my game, with the Outer Worlds as well, just that retro future, a very specific story they're wanting to tell with a character that you actually get invested in. I think that stuff is great. Which is why I love Uncharted 2. Uncharted 2 is one of my favorite games of all time.
Yeah, it's pretty great, especially for the time it came out. It was an impressive game at that time. Oh my god.
Yeah, it was so confident.
The game I was talking about was Hi-Fi Rush.
Okay.
Yeah, but BioShock Infinite always ranks as one of my favorite. I think people get weird about that game, about Lunar Distance, whatever. I remember just being so excited about the concept of time travel. Every time a song would appear from our world into that game in a different version, it just set the tone so well. Great, great pick. Glad to see there's other BioShock Infinite fans out there.
I the art design and just the arenas are just, they have this almost Pixar aesthetic to them, but
yeah,
horror. So I think that's awesome.
Yeah, definitely like coming out of the prior BioShocks of like, now everything's going to be bright and colorful and up in the air, and just that juxtaposition of that with all of the horror elements. It's like, I forget whose quote this was, but just being able to make things scary during the day when the sun is out is a real art, because, you know, people want to make it dark and gory, and it's like, you know, that's a simpler thing to do, to make that vibe scary. So
I think the contrast, a lot of games that do contrast, like, I think that's why like mascot horror is very popular. It's that contrast between like cutesy and scary, and that dissonance like almost makes it creepier.
Yeah, a little bit.
This isn't meant to be scary.
Little Lethal Company.
Some Lethal Company. Some what's the Five Nights at Freddy's? It's like all those sorts of things.
Well, I think there's something great about taking kind of an identity and completely flipping it. Like for BioShock, the original ones, it was unwavering, like independent, like isolationism. I could do everything on my own. To like the scary patriotism and like almost like religious and patriotism tied together in BioShock Infinite was just like, oh, this is terrifying. And everybody's singing a song together and like all chanting. Oh, all right, good.
Yeah, the theocratic nature of that is very interesting. And I like that those the two games like skewer different things. You know, it's like Ayn Rand, like into self-actualization, and then, you know, like religious patriotism. Yeah. That's cool. I did have something else I wanted to ask you guys about.
Oh, please, yeah.
What are you playing right now?
Go ahead, Phil.
It's been a lot of Helldivers 2. I feel like every time they drop a new update, I'm like, oh, okay, let me peep back in there. I love the meta narrative of that game and the way that they kind of like invite you back in every couple of weeks, even if you go play something else. And then Dragon's Dogma 2.
I think that's genius what they're doing with a live service, like putting this narrative wrapper on the whole thing, so that every patch and every update is all like still in the lore. That like maybe the first game did that, but I've not seen that, and I think I could see that being a whole new like type of live service, is where you're kind of almost everyone's kind of role playing almost in the same universe, and like updates are about more roleplay opportunities as opposed to like getting new items or like getting new currency. So I think that is why it's been such a massive, massive hit.
Yeah. I've definitely been roleplaying. I love Helldiver. Honestly, it's kind of, this might be a bit of hyperbole.
All right. Can't wait.
But I kind of feel like it's a little bit of like Moneyball, where it's like all of these companies are making live service games right now. And to me, it's like, if you're working on a live service game and you haven't seen what Helldivers is doing, like you're in the past.
Well, it's a whole new paradigm.
Yeah.
Truly. I mean, it's a new paradigm. And it's what I think it shows is that, I don't know if it's because the state of the world just in general, but people really are thirsting to like be united in some virtual place. Yeah. Like people just want to be in a world together where we're all working together. And like, that's what this game has done. And look how huge it is. Like, I think that is so interesting.
Yeah. We've discussed it a lot on the podcast, and just on our last episode, we were talking about how people are gravitating more toward cooperative games. I mean, that's not to say that the battle royales and stuff aren't still very popular, but
of course,
but like I feel like battle royale has been, you know, the king genre for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years now, and so like seeing a game like Helldivers where there's no PvP element whatsoever, and it you have more people online than like, you know, a Call of Duty Warzone or something like that, I think really it says a lot. And I know for me personally, I'm much more of a cooperative player. So
I am too. I love cooperative games. I've been getting into tabletop games, and like the cooperative ones are the ones I like. Right. Coming up with stories with your friends.
Yeah.
What's better than that?
All right. Well, I think that is going to wrap us up for this bonus episode of the GGG podcast. I want to say that Phil, thank you as always for being here. And Austin, especially thank you for coming on our show. We appreciate it. And, you know, I hope a lot of people out there are looking forward to the Outer Worlds too. I know that I am. I'm very curious to see what you've been working on personally. So,
Yeah. All right. Thanks for having me. This is a lot of fun.
All right. Peace out, everybody.